How many of you were here this weekend to hear that monk Utejaniya speak? So actually less than I thought were here. So there were a lot of people from our community at his teachings this weekend. He taught all weekend here, Saturday and Sunday. And it was quite wonderful to have him teach here. And he had a particular way of teaching the mindfulness practice. And I thought that it might be interesting to discuss it a little bit today, or if people would want to ask questions about it who were there. But many people weren't there, so that's what makes it a little bit awkward. So what I thought of doing then is try my best of my ability to recapitulate a little bit what his teachings were, how he taught, how he teaches. And and what he didn't say in the public talk was a little bit about himself. It was a little bit interesting. Over lunch, we heard more about his life a little bit. And he'd only been ordained something like 11 or 12 years, which is relatively a short time to end up being a teacher of his prominence and traveling abroad and things, especially in Burma. However, he practiced for many years before he became a monk with one of the famous teachers in Burma. And started as a teenager when he was 13. And a year or two after being ordained, his teacher said, "And I think you should need to start teaching." And so it kind of, you know, because he was being pushed into it. And he doesn't see himself as a Dharma teacher. He sees himself as a meditation instructor. So those of you who are here on both Saturday and Sunday, he gave what he calls his instructional talk. And he gives that same instructional talk everywhere he goes, if people want the instructions. So he has a particular way of giving instructions. And then what he loves doing is being in dialogue with people. People will try to put the practice he teaches into practice, and then they come and report to him what that's like. And then he explores it with him, kind of in that exploration. That's what he really likes. That's what he seems to be very good at. And the idea of giving a Dharma talk is not something that he feels qualified to do. He can give instructions. So he's a meditation instructor. And he said that, and also he's a little bit unusual for a lot of the Burmese teachers, because a lot of the most famous Burmese teachers became monks when they were teenagers. And so they kind of, their whole adult life was kind of in robes. And he became a monk when he was something like 35 or 37, I think. And so he was a businessman. He ran in Burma, some kind of clothes making factory, and sold his clothes in the market, the famous market in Rangoon, and was married and has a child. So he kind of knows a little bit about that world, business and family and stuff like that, and kind of intimately, in the way that some Burmese teachers don't know because they were monks since they were kids. And he said at some point, I don't know how long ago, maybe 17 years ago or so, he found himself depressed, which is also a very modern illness. It's a modern condition that a lot of people in the West have. So he shares a lot of things with Westerners, a lot of Westerners at least, you know, people here in this country. You know, work, family, and depression. Then he started meditating, and the meditation led really far for him. You know, eventually became a teacher monk and a teacher. So someone at lunch asked him, "You must have had a lot of faith when you were depressed. You had a lot of faith in meditation." He said, "No, I didn't have much faith in meditation. I was just desperate. I'd reached the end of my rope," what he said. "There was nothing else to try." So he kind of half-heartedly tried the meditation, and it was really hard for him. His mind wandered a lot, and it was really hard. And he stayed depressed. But because his mind, he was trying to follow his breath at his nostril, which is a classic place to watch the breath in meditation. And in order to kind of succeed, you know, even for a little bit, he had some kind of like menthol inhaler. And he would put that up in his nostrils and take a sniff. And then he had all these sensations at his nostrils so he could, you know, be more compelling to stay present. You know. Instead of have, you know, in addition to the hearing assistant devices by the door, we could have menthol sprays, nasal sprays. And he said, so he did this thing, and with his nose. And then for a very brief moment, he was there with the sensations in his nose. He said, it didn't last long. A very brief moment, his depression vanished, went away. And then it came back. But he had a taste that it was could vanish. He realized it wasn't, his mind wasn't stuck in that pattern of being depressed. There was an option of being another way. And that caught his attention. And he said, from then on, he never looked back. And then he got so interested in meditation, what meditation can do, that he had this, I think, very natural curiosity and interest that kept him very compelled him or kept him strongly motivated to keep looking very closely at his experience of what was going on in his practice. And that interest and that curiosity kind of opened the door. And he then practiced, and one of the qualities of his teaching, and I think coming from his teacher, is that he does not put a lot of emphasis on sitting meditation. There are some Burmese teachers that are this way. Generally in Buddhism, in Burmese Buddhism, there's a lot of emphasis on formal meditation practice. And there are a few Burmese teachers who de-emphasize that. Another one in America who de-emphasizes it is a teacher in Santa Rosa named Dr. Tintin. She has a little center up in Santa Rosa and teaching in the West for, I don't know, many years now. Lovely woman. And so when you do retreats with her, sometimes you have to go into the kitchen with her and chop vegetables and cook and, you know, with her. And that's the retreat, is the practicing daily life, practicing as you live and as you talk and do everything. So for him, having to run a business and family and things like that, then he really applied himself to his meditation, to his mindfulness practice, not only in meditation, but also in daily life. And so one of his key teachings, which is now very common in Vipassana, which he really emphasized a lot, was the continuity of practice. And for him, you have to develop that continuity in your daily life. And it builds, the practice builds from that. Apparently he tried a few times to went off and become a monk. Like, you know, you can do temporary ordinations in Theravada and Buddhism. So he went off for three or four times off and became a monk for a little while. Somehow it didn't stick or didn't work or, I don't know, just he had things to go back to. And then at some point he felt some radical shift in his mind, and he felt that somehow he had finished with certain kind of lay life. And when his son was 9 months old, he announced he was going to go off and be ordained again. And people thought, he kind of didn't say anything, but the assumption was that it was another one of these temporary ordinations. And so they were home waiting for him and after a while they realized he wasn't going to come back. And so then he stayed as a monk. And so we were all concerned about the state of his family. He was taking care of his family. And he said, his wife actually had her own business. So in terms of financial ability, that was okay. And they don't live so far away from him and his monastery. So his son actually comes and visits him several times a week. He's in touch with his son. And also his wife now comes and meditates with him as well. So it is what it is. So his teaching, he put a big emphasis on mindfulness. But for him, it was very important that there was a certain kind of wisdom or understanding, intelligence that stands behind the mindfulness. And one of those things he called was the right attitude and the right view, the right understanding about how you practice mindfulness. He would say that mindfulness by itself is not enough. There has to be paired together with some right understanding. And for him, one of the first kind of pieces or foundation for this right understanding is understanding the primacy of the mind. That in mindfulness, it's the mind that knows. That which knows is the mind. This is kind of tautology. It's the mind that knows. And so that's really where the primary focus, his meditation practice is on the mind, as opposed to some Burmese traditions where the primary focus is the body. And so you kind of spend a lot of time focusing on the body, some aspect of the body, and really to kind of develop the practice through the body. For him, in order to know the bodily sensations when you do body meditation, like the breath, for example, the mind has to know that. The mind is what knows that you're with the breath. So he then focuses on what the quality of the mind is, as opposed to what's going on with the sensations. Sensations are just an excuse to know the mind, because you have to know something to know the mind. The mind doesn't know itself without knowing something, is his way of understanding. And so he doesn't really care that much what the mind is focusing on. So he doesn't emphasize just be with the breath to really, you know, get focused there. He prefers, that's why, you know, anything works. And so for him, as is often the case in Vipassana, there's no such thing as distractions. It's just something else to pay attention to. And as you pay attention to it, is part of the function of this developing the knowing of something, is to see what's your attitude with which you know something. And then cultivating the right attitude, holding the experience in the right way. And so for him, the right attitude is first, if you're focusing on the quality of the mind, and that there is no greed, hate, and delusion in your mind in relationship to what you're knowing. So if you want something to happen, then he said there was greed in the mind. So if you're trying to get concentrated, you want to get concentrated, then you're grasping onto something. Or if you want something to go away, then there's aversion. Or if you don't know what's going on, then he said there's delusion. And those are called the three poisons in Buddhism: greed, hate, and delusion. And so he said the right attitude is one where there's neither greed, neither wanting something to happen, nor aversion, or wanting something to go away, not to happen. And to not want what is happening is a form of aversion for him. And so that's having the wrong attitude. And to want what's happening is also a form of greed, and that's also a wrong attitude. And so he kind of falls into the camp of people who emphasize acceptance of experience, or non-reactivity to experience, being present with an attitude that has neither greed nor aversion in it, or delusion or confusion in it. And he also emphasizes the tremendous importance of being relaxed. And one of the reasons I think a number of Westerners who were practicing Burma, when I started practicing with him, is because some of the teachers in Burma emphasize heroic effort. Strive. My teacher said in Burma, strive, Gil, strive. And when he told me strive, I came back the next day and I said, I didn't come to Burma to strive. I came here just to be present for what is, and not to push for something and strive, just to be really fully present for this experience here. He said, yeah, that's what I'm teaching. It's fine, you know. And so I thought we had an understanding. And then the next day I came back for interview and he said, strive. So I didn't try to get more clarification then. I just let it go. Some of the various teachers that Westerners have practiced with, kind of emphasis on striving, and it can be interpreted by some as really, you know, kind of intense, kind of pushing and trying. And so some of the Westerners who studied with him, just the striving teachers, then loved going to this teacher because he says, relax, relax. You don't have to sit so much. Relax. If you have pain, don't struggle with the pain. If you're struggling with the pain, then there's aversion in your mind, and that's wrong attitude. So if there's pain and you're struggling, just, you know, get up and walk and do something else. Keep being mindful all the time. So he emphasizes being relaxed. And part what comes out of relaxation for him is the mind's natural capacity to know. A relaxed mind will be aware of something. Doesn't matter what for him. A natural mind will effortlessly be aware. You don't have to put effort into knowing if you keep the mind relaxed. So, you know, if I tell all of you, please, stop paying attention. Just stop it. Enough of this. Enough, stop. you might stop paying attention to me, but you can't turn off your attention. You can't turn off your awareness. And it kind of comes pretty easily. I mean, some of the things that you're aware of in the room right now that are kind of on the edges of your awareness are coming into your awareness pretty effortlessly. I can look around and see the colors of some of your shirts. You know, it's kind of on the edges, you know, it just comes in, that, you know, awareness comes in pretty easily and effortlessly. So his emphasis also is becoming aware of what comes in effortlessly, being effortless with the awareness. And now, of course, it's easy to be effortlessly aware for a moment, and then the mind wanders off. And so for him, the idea is to develop continuity of practice, and build up momentum. So he knows that you can't do it, you know, initially very well, but you keep coming back to relaxing and being present and having the right attitude to what your experience is. And if you keep doing it, then with time, you build up momentum. Now, momentum, you know, it might take quite a while. And he recognized that that in some meditation traditions, you can go really deep in practice much faster than his tradition, because sometimes when you have a kind of more one-pointed focus and strident effort, you can go deep and narrow very quickly. But for him, the idea of building up momentum takes much longer. But then I think he understands it's much more stable and more realistic, because then you can apply it in all areas of your life, as opposed to only being able to have this very strong mindfulness in daily, you know, on retreat. And so the idea is you build up momentum, and then as you build up momentum by the continuity of practice, having this right attitude, which is focusing on the quality of the mind, your mind stays relaxed. Now, there's plenty of practitioners who are very good at focusing their attention at something. So they might focus on the breath. You're told to focus on the breath. I'm going to focus on the breath. And people get very good. It can be very nice. It can be very focused, very concentrated. Or they're focused on something else, feelings, or whatever it might be. They're focused on something. But it's kind of like you're focused, and you don't know. So, like, if the hand is the focus, then, you know, you're focused this way at something, but you don't notice the quality of the focus. And so the focus might be actually tight or straining, or it might be kind of, you know, too laid back, too kind of hesitant or something, or not knowing what to focus on. So for him, it's very important to focus on the quality of the focus, or the quality of the knowing, the quality of the awareness, the quality of the mind that knows. And if you do that, you'll notice if that quality is off in some way, if it's characterized by what he called greed, hate, or delusion, or if it's not, the absence of those. And so I've seen this many times, that how often people, you know, are so kind of, you know, fixated on looking at something that they don't notice what they're looking at. And it's a very important point in Vipassana practice, mindfulness practice, is when the mind gets stable enough that they actually turn the attention around to look at the quality of the mind that knows. And then, you know, start studying that and be aware of that. So that gets set right as well. And then you stay much more relaxed, and the practice becomes much more kind of easeful and enjoyable, in a sense, because you're not going to have a tense or aversive or striving or pushing kind of mind. Just the mind can stay much softer. So he said that, I don't know if he said it to the whole, maybe he said it to everyone here, but he said when he teaches his practice to teenagers, he says, he uses his hand this way. He says, it's like, or like this, something, because it's like going like this, he said. It's going from this way to going this way. So it's having this focus that's external to somehow turning the lens of attention 180 degrees and turning in. So always coming back and looking at the mind. He's so interested in the mind, looking at the quality of the mind. Now, some of the people I know who've studied with him, who have many, many years of meditation practice, and have practiced, you know, very deeply in many ways, said that their meditation actually went deeper with his kind of teaching, you know, focusing on the quality of the mind. And it was much more relaxed and spacious for them. So best of my kind of hearing him, understanding him, that's kind of the basic gist of his teaching. And then the question is, you put it into practice, you try it. And so then you try it and see what it's like. And then if you have difficulties, then you come and maybe talk to him. And what he didn't make clear in his public talks, I would say it this way, his public talks, you get a sense that he has one way of teaching. He has kind of a particular way of teaching. But when he talks with people one-on-one, then he'll give people lots of other practices as well. Then he varies it, because he realizes that human beings have a very wide range of dispositions, and not all people are prepared or ready for the kind of practice he's teaching. And so you have to be able to do different things. And so there was some discussion about someone who asked a question, and it seemed that the person didn't really have the ability to understand what he was saying, or at least take it in, because the mind was so caught in the world of stories and the world of thinking. And they were kind of like, sometimes the mind can get stuck in its thinking mode, and it can't even see beyond its own thinking walls. It can't really take in information from outside and see itself. And so for that person, there was discussion with that person. His instructions weren't really appropriate for that person. What that person maybe needs to do is do concentration practice, because concentration practice can somehow help the mind step out of itself, step out of the normal kind of habit formations of the mind. And once it steps out, it can see, it can be available for new information. It can kind of understand things anew. So in the public talk, it didn't seem that, it seemed like this is the way you do it. This is the way. And in the private conversations, it became clear that he actually had a much wider view of how to practice than what was clear from his public talks. And that comes out more than if you do this one-on-one, exchange with him. So those of you who were there this weekend, did I represent him accurately enough, close enough, or did I miss something, or did I get a little bit wrong? Anyone? Yes. Yes.
One of the things, Gil, that I heard him say, or I thought I did, was along the lines of what you were just saying, is that he tries to give someone a practice to do based on their skills. And from what you were saying, it sounds like the particular guy maybe hadn't developed the skill of concentration, and I'm not sure how one would apply otherwise if somebody was too much spun up in their thoughts. But did I get that part? And also, what other sort of difficulties or practices might he give that that you've seen as a frequent concern of students?
Uh-huh. Well, the first one, I don't think I was there maybe for the part where he talked about giving everyone something according to their skill. I had the sense that in private conversation with him that sometimes he's, sometimes you give something that it goes along with their strong quality. And you take their strong quality. You talked about that privately, about some people's strong point is effort, some people's concentration, some people's wisdom, some people's faith. And so you kind of work with the strong quality they have. But also I think sometimes you need to actually provide the medicine, the antidote to some quality which is not so skillful, not so helpful in order to help. So maybe both ways depending on the person. And then the second question was?
What are the major areas, and maybe you said that already,
So where they had difficulties. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't around that much to know what the address is. He said that. He did address the issue of the wandering mind, and he made clear, I think, what's often made clear by Vipassana teachers, that the wandering mind doesn't need to be seen as a distraction or a problem. It becomes you can focus on that, bring your attention to that, and then develop right attitude towards that. And if you have aversion to your wandering mind, that's wrong attitude. If you want to get rid of your thinking mind, that's wrong attitude. If you want to hold on to it, that's also wrong attitude. But just allowing it to be there and having this relaxed awareness of its presence and looking at the quality of the mind that knows is, so I think part of the task of this kind of practice is keep showing people how to bring attention to all aspects of experience, including the wandering mind. So what kind of difficulties people have, I don't know. This is my first contact with him. So,
I mean, from your experience.
Or what kind of problems people have?
Yeah, what are the main themes that you see that
other main primary themes that you see with students coming to you that perhaps along the lines of what you're talking about, maybe they can concentrate or maybe they can't or whatever, that perhaps would relate to all of us to one degree or another in the room, that whether you'd use the use that skill, or whether, as you said, you'd use maybe the opposite. Are there major areas?
I don't know. I don't know about common. I think that pretty much anybody who meditates, sooner or later, will wonder if they have attention deficit disorder. And so, that's kind of comes with the territory. And so, working with a mind that wanders away and bringing it back is very important. And then looking at our relationship to ourselves and our experience and what's going on is very important. He calls it the right attitude, or having the right, looking at our attitude. Other teachers, sometimes here in the West, are talking about at some point it's important to study your relationship to experience. What your experience is not so important, it's your relationship to it that you have to look at. So it's the kind of same thing. And so when we start looking at the relationship, then we find that for some people it gets really messy. And here in the West, there's a fair amount of difficulty that around the whole notion of self-concept, self-identity, and sometimes, and so this whole, there's kind of tremendous suffering and attachments and neurosis and things around the whole idea of self here in this, in our country, and here in the West. And sometimes it takes a form of tremendous amount of self-loathing or lack of self-esteem or something. And so sometimes that has to be addressed. And one of the reasons why loving-kindness practice is taught, first was being taught in the West, was an antidote for self-loathing and self-hate, which was a big one. It depends. Some people have a big issue in their mind. A useful kind of list to look at for the common difficulties human beings have are three poisons. Some people struggle more with desire. Some people more with aversion. Some people more with delusion. Some people, that's a great list. And so, like for myself, desires, historically been, more my hindrance than aversion. So I have to kind of work with desire more. Other people, their hindrance is more aversion, and that's how that's going to work with that. Aversion is a much more painful obstacle to deal with. But it's said that it's actually a better hindrance to have than desire. Because even though it's more painful, they say that people who have aversion will be much more motivated and directed to kind of stop their aversive qualities, or kind of say no to the things that you say no to in your mind. Enough of that. I'm not going to do that. So it's said that the path can go faster for people who have aversion. You have to use your aversion to kind of that quality in your favor. Yes? Maybe Matt's been waiting here.
Yesterday afternoon, he was talking about somebody asked him directly a question about dealing with their depression, and he absolutely did not answer it in that more standard way that you had mentioned earlier today. So I think that was something. He said you really had to come to him, and he needs to know more about you to be able to make any kind of a cookie cutter explanation. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, he talked about when he had been in New York, this woman who was in manufacturing or something. She was in computers, that was it. And he really liked the idea of the elements, little data elements, become information, and information, if you really work with it, can become knowledge, and knowledge applied can become wisdom, kind of move through the whole thing of moving toward wisdom, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, so for him, wisdom and insight arises naturally when there's enough continuity of awareness. And for him, a continuity of awareness allows you to kind of have a bigger and bigger stream of data, he said, more and more information about what's going on. In a very natural, easy way, you take in more. And at some point, you take in enough that the mind begins to see it with wisdom. And that wisdom, then, and so that's one of the things we're aiming at, what he's aiming at, is developing a mind that has wisdom as a quality of it, which is insight and seeing clearly and deeply. And then at some point, I think he said this more privately, at some point, when he said nirvana is the object of the mind when the mind is completely wholesome. So when the mind kind of reaches a certain kind of perfection of wisdom, then it naturally takes nirvana as an object. So there's a kind of progression for him. Definitely progression. It isn't like you're supposed to, to deeper and deeper practice. The other thing, So Matt, please.
Gil, I have a question. If you're doing, you know, the mindfulness meditation that we learn here with the breath as the anchor, and you want to incorporate some of his teachings in with that, do you divide your attention between the breath and the quality of mind, or do you focus on the quality of mind only, or how do you do that?
It really depends on the person and where you are in your practice. I think for someone who's relatively new to practice, sometimes it's more useful to have the very simple basic idea, just be relaxed and be at ease with what's going on. Don't try to make something happen, but let's use the breath as a place to help stabilize the mind so the mind is not wandering so much, and let's stay there and stabilize. At some point when the mind gets stabilized, then there can be a moment where it's appropriate to look then at the quality of the mind. But if you look every 2 seconds, you know, it's kind of neurotic looking and back and forth, then you might stay more agitated. It's not so useful. So when the magic moment is when you want to look at the quality of the mind, that varies from person to person depending on what's going on. I mean, some people should look at the quality of the mind right away. Don't even wait to look at the breath. because it's such a big, you know, obvious thing. And some people, perhaps it can wait quite a while because maybe the mind is basically pretty balanced. But it's subtle. There might be some subtle defilements there that are operating. And so you need to get the mind pretty settled and quiet so people see the subtlety of what's happening. So you have to kind of intuit and use your intelligence, which is the word he used a lot. Use your intelligence to know exactly when to look. Yes, you're right.
Did he talk at all about the right amount of effort?
I wasn't there the whole weekend. What I heard him talk about over and over again was more of an effortless quality, being relaxed and letting the effort just be the kind of arise naturally. And what he said is, if you do that initially, you might not have a lot of kind of continuity of effort, but if you keep doing it, just kind of waking up to what's here and be present in a relaxed way, then with time a momentum starts being built, a momentum of effort, and the energy that comes, the effort that comes for him is a natural effort. That's a natural sense of vitality begins becoming stronger and stronger. And so rather than something, a willful effort, where you're making will to kind of apply effort and do effort, there's no will involved. It's kind of a, you know, natural effort that bubbles up. It's like if you've just been to the gym and you feel all pumped up with good energy, you walk down the street with a spring in your gait. And then, you know, it's like not like you're trying to, because there's all this energy coursing through you. So in that way, as you start off, you don't start off that way in practice, but if you keep trying to do the continuity thing, which he emphasized, which you're trying to do as much best you can, then with time, the effort, the energy kind of builds up momentum. Does that make sense? So he's very forgiving about where you're at. You don't have to be, for him, you don't have to be any different than who you are. Well, there is a kind of effort in the sense that, I think if I can characterize him, I think that what he said was that, say something like this, like, if you're lost in sloth, in sleepiness, you know, in love, there's no problem. You know, you're too lost to know there's a problem. But if you know that you have sloth and sleepiness, if you know, that's enough knowing. And it's very interesting to notice when the mind drifts off in thought or is sleepy, and you come back, the first moment or two, or initially coming back, is effortless. You know, you didn't have to. Then people will say, oh, I have to pay more attention. Then they gear themselves up and they try hard and they, you know, all this stuff happens. But the initial moment was quite effortless. Oh, I'm wondering. Oh, I'm a terrible meditator. I shouldn't be doing that. But the first moment was quite pure. And so he wants to emphasize that first moment, say, you got it. That's it. And it happened in a relaxed way. You just became aware. There's no problem. If you think then that sloth is a problem, it shouldn't be there, then you have wrong attitude. Then there's aversion. So look at the quality of the mind. Look at that. So he said, look at that aversion. And that's really what's interesting, is to look at the aversion, not the sloth, and then kind of settle that. And one of his teachings was, as I understood it, was that some things, you know, maybe are undesirable. You know, they're painful to have, certain qualities of mind, like aversion. And some things don't go away just like that. It's like a magic key or formula, just makes it all go away. Some things go away because you really paid attention to it a lot and really got to know it well. And so for him, you have to be very patient. Just get to know it. So if you have sloth, make that your what you're going to do your PhD on. You know, just like, oh, that's what sloth is like. And I think there's a lot of wisdom that and freedom that comes from familiarity. And that's bad news. Because familiarity means you got to see it again and again and again. But we're impatient, which is wrong attitude. Right? But slowly, you guys are looking at these attitudes you have, and slowly they begin to transform into change. And I believe for him, it's more of a natural transformation. I don't think, did he talk this weekend? Did he use the language of letting go at all this weekend? Did anybody remember him saying let go of something? No one remembers anything about letting go?
He mentioned
clinging. Right. But he didn't tell you to let go of anything, did he? This weekend? Confuse the mic, please.
I think he said you can't let go. That once you understand properly, then it's gone.
Then it's gone, yeah.
Shall I say that?
Say it again, please, yes.
Is it on? No.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I think what I think I heard was that you said you can't let go. It's not possible to let go. But with proper understanding, whatever it is just disappears on its own.
Yes. And so it takes a while to get that proper understanding, so that familiarity that is important to keep, you know. But then if you get impatient, well, this should go away by now, that's wrong attitude. So you keep coming back to this right attitude, and the advantage of that is the right attitude is relaxed. You know, it's peaceful. So you keep coming back to a place where the mind is peaceful. You try to, at least. And then, so one of the things he said was, maybe, I don't know if he said it in public talks, but his emphasis is not on experience, but rather on insight. So his emphasis is not on having some kind of meditation experience. And it's there's a lot of people who meditate who are looking for an experience. And he said, experience is just another thing to have right attitude towards, another thing to be aware of. And he keeps coming back to the awareness and having the right attitude to what's arising. Don't look for an experience. Don't hold on to experience. Don't, you know, try to have a pleasant experience or something, or a deep meditation experience. That's not the point. Point is not experience. And in saying that, that's something that's relatively orthodox in classic Buddhism, the idea that experience is not really where it's at. I think maybe it was Joseph Goldstein who coined the phrase, we're not trying to, how do you say it? Mindfulness is not about having a different experience. It's about seeing experience in a new way. It's not having a new experience, it's seeing experience in a new way. And so, you know, so it's always good to remember, we're not trying to, so you're not trying to settle, oh, I got it, that's it. Like sometimes in meditation you can feel wonderfully peaceful, relaxed, joyful. And it's very easy to say, oh, good, I've arrived. This is good. I'm going to, oh, this is wonderful. Like, you know, this is what it's all about. And in doing that, you stop the continuity of mindfulness. You stop, say, oh, this is what's going on. And there might also be a very subtle, in his language, defilement. Because there's a little bit of feeling, oh, this is good, I got something, I'm going to hold on to that. Rather for him, oh, you just keep going. Oh, pleasant, you know, it's nice, it's soft, it's warm, it's settled, it's peaceful. Oh, just be aware of that, just be aware of that. And what's the attitude? What's the attitude? As the mind gets more and more... He also said that concentration is important. I don't know if he said this publicly, but concentration is important. But for him, concentration follows naturally the mindfulness. It's not something you need to willfully try to cultivate, but follows in the wake of mindfulness. And when the concentration is strong, then at some point, you know, I think that it becomes easier and easier, more and more natural to look at the quality of the mind. And many, many meditators will say that. if they're focusing on just on the breath, kind of staying with the breath, not looking at anything else, at some point the mind gets quiet enough and concentrated enough that what stands out in relief, in highlight, is the mind that knows. So some people just wait until when the mind becomes highlighted, the knowing mind becomes highlighted, and that's when they focus on the quality of the mind. And he kind of just encourages people to do it quite a bit earlier, not waiting until kind of the natural time that arises. Yeah. Microphone, please. Maybe this can be the last question.
What I was observing here is the surrender and the letting go of letting go and staying out of control for me, and just concentrating on whatever and just accepting it and then surrendering and letting go, but then coming back to breath and kind of like using both techniques in and out. And I find when I'm around other beings doing the same thing, that it intensifies. And that my mindfulness of the mind is that the mind in other areas is also mind, all one. And then it gets mindful of that mind, of being one. And it feels good to be here.
Thank you. So, I found the monk this weekend a delight. He was very happy to listen to his teachings, and I think some of you who were here this weekend probably felt the same way. And I did invite him back, and he thought maybe he could think about coming in 2009. It's not that far away, and because you know his schedule and stuff, and he said that I asked him if he was interested in doing a retreat. And when we put on a retreat here for him, and when I said that to him, he said, "Oh, I did a retreat in Korea recently, and the way it worked was that we had three sessions a day, for an hour and a half or so, and people would come and meditate a little bit, and then we'd be in dialogue, like he likes to do, right? And then they'd go home or go to work or do their life, and then they'd come back and talk about what they experienced, what their practice was like doing that." And so there was this going back and forth and applying the practice not in silent retreat mode, but in daily life. And so we pretty much got the sense, or he was explicit when we asked him, that that's what he'd prefer. We asked him, if we do a retreat, if we put on a retreat so you can teach for us, would you like to go off in a retreat center where everybody can go off and be in residence? Or should you do it here at IMC where people can come and go? Oh yeah, let's do it here at IMC and people can spend the week coming and going. And as you know, that's the advanced practice. So maybe he'll come back. And yes, Betsy. Well, he didn't go into great detail with him, but he said that he felt that he used the language cut off, that something was really cut off, because people asked him was that difficult to go off and be a monk and you know like that. So it was already cut off was the expression he used. So what he meant by what was cut off wasn't clear, but or a certain kind of involvement, a certain kind of way of thinking or being in the world or something that was finished for him. It just wasn't there anymore. And so it was quite natural or easy for him. At least that's kind of the sense that what he reported. So, I don't know what was going on for him. So thank you, everyone.